This is The Tenth Voice, Kansas City's gay and lesbian radio magazine. The Tenth Voice, because you refuse to be silent.
And I'm Elizabeth Anderson, your host for today on the Santa Moran Radio Book Club. We have a very exciting mystery-themed show for you today. As Stephanie Duell said, there's going to be mayhem, but will there be murder? We're going to be talking to Cheryl Head, author of the Charlie Mack Motown Mysteries, and her latest one is Catch Me When I'm Falling. And then the second half of the hour, we'll be talking to Ann Apteker with her fourth Cantor Gold mystery, Flesh and Gold. I have read all of the Charlie Mack mysteries, and I have read all of the Cantor Gold. So my panelist today is Linda Wilson, who is the producer and sound engineer of The Tenth Voice, the umbrella show for the Santa Moran Radio Book Club. And I should probably disclose that the Charlie Mack Motown mysteries are published by Bywater Books, and I am a Bywater Books editor.
Hi there. How are you, Elizabeth?
I'm fine. And I want to start out talking about the month that you have had. You live in Washington, D.C., but you were first in Chicago and then in New Orleans, where I saw you all over the place. And now you're at Women's Fest in Rehoboth Beach. Would you tell a little about what you've been doing this past month?
Yes, I'm happy to. It's been a whirlwind month. I said to myself earlier in the year that I wouldn't say no to any invitation, and it's taking its toll on me, but I'm having a ball. So today I am at the second day of the Women's Fest in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware. It's fabulous. The rain has stopped. It's a nice day at the beach. We've been selling books and talking about books and reading books. We just heard a keynote from Pam Stewart, who's the chair of the foundation of GLAAD, and we're having a ball here in Rehoboth. Earlier, a couple weeks ago, I was in St. Sinners in New Orleans with you. That's a fabulous literary festival where our men and women writers come together, and honored to be able to moderate a panel with Dorothy Allison and Blanche McCrary Boyd and the fabulous poet Judy Ron talking about radical lesbian feminism and writing. That was a ball. I was inducted into the Hall of Fame at the Saints and Sinners Festival. So honored to be joining a group of luminaries who are in the Hall of Fame. And then in Chicago earlier in the month, mid-March, I was teaching a class called Characters Not Caricatures, Writing People Who Are Not Like You, and also doing a panel at the Murder and Mayhem Fest Literary Conference, because I write mysteries.
You're making me tired.
And I'm tired.
I also saw you on a panel with Jean Redman, moderated by Eric Andrews Katz, talking about mystery writing.
That was fun. Jean has a fabulous series, the Mickey Knight series, and also like another standalone series, so I felt honored to be having that conversation with her.
Let's talk a little bit about writing mysteries. What you set you on this path, because you are a longtime broadcaster.
Correct. When I took an early retirement from public broadcasting, did it to not solely to write a book, but I had a book that I'd been working on, which is historical fiction, a labor of love, a look at the Negro soldiers of World War II, who are not the Tuskegee Airmen or the people who fought on the battlegrounds, because 85% of black soldiers during World War II stayed stateside. And so I wrote a story about the experiences of a young man and a young woman who were Army private first class, and had a ball writing that. I spent a lot of time in the Library of Congress doing the research on the Times and on the military, and I wanted to do honor to the story. So after I got that book out into the world, I decided I wanted to do a fun writing project. And reading mysteries has always been a love interest of mine. I love all kinds of mysteries, and I read all across the board. And I decided to write a mystery. And I literally, probably from conception to publishing, was about 6 months. And it was just fun to do. I love puzzles. I love putting together puzzles. I love being able to keep a reader in suspense so they don't know who did it until almost the end of the book. And so I'm enjoying writing the series I'm working on now.
Well, wonderful. And I want to bring Linda Wilson, our sound engineer and producer, into this because she loves mysteries and she loves figuring out puzzles.
Yes. Well.
Oh, wonderful. Hi, Linda.
Hi. I just read your first book, Wake Me When It's Over. Is that the
second book?
Second book. And
yeah,
that was the first book up for me. And,
okay, good.
And now I wish I started with the first book.
Oh, nice.
I really enjoyed it, and my wife kept saying, you must really like that book because you're not putting it down. In fact, I stayed up till about 3 o'clock in the morning to finish it. And I don't usually do that. I usually read it like for half an hour in the morning, and half an hour in the afternoon, and a little bit at night. So I read your book all day.
Oh, my.
And it's really good. You really write a tight novel, and you follow through with, because I remember fun little facts about something, and I'm like, you know, and then I think you forgot about it, and then like 100 pages later, you bring it back in, and you tie it up, and you're really good at that, and I really enjoyed it.
I'm glad to hear that.
Let's talk about the evolution of your main character, Charlie Mack, because the Charlie Mack that I met in Bury Me When I'm Dead, your first novel, is not the same exact woman in Wake Me When It's Over and Catch Me When I'm Falling. Could you talk a little about her evolution?
Yes, indeed. So Charlie is a smart Detroit woman. I'm born and raised in Detroit, and it's a city where black women have a certain amount of power in the family, in the government, in the nonprofit world. Charlie is a really independent person. She has a person who's had a lot of professional success. She has been, she's a lawyer. She has a black belt in a couple of martial arts. She has had a couple of businesses of her own. And at 32, she decides to become an agent in the Department of Homeland Security and leaves Homeland Security to form her own firm because she's at the heart of it very entrepreneurial. She's also a person who would not label herself bisexual, but she is. And in book one, Charlie meets the woman who will become the love of her life, Mandy Porter, another very successful, beautiful woman who's a police officer in one of the suburban police forces in Detroit. And in book one, they are having they're beginning their romance, you know? And then in book two, they are working together on a case and solidifying their relationship. And in the third book, Catch Me When I'm Falling, which launched last month, they are about to move in together into their first happy home.
One of the things that I appreciate so much about Charlie and about you as an author is that you blend race, gender, age, because her mother has early onset Alzheimer's, class. Certainly in the third book, though, the one that you've just published, Charlie goes into the shadows and she disguises herself, and you do such a good job of moving Charlie through these different worlds and showing intersectionality. Could you talk a little about that?
Well, that's a great question. Thank you. So diversity is very important to me, and when I say diversity, I mean it very broadly. Diversity of thought and perspective, but ethnicity and race, of course, language, sexual orientation, and gender expression, all of those things come into play in the book.
I want to talk a little about some reviews that we have of Cheryl's book. One is from Penny Mickleberry, who has been on the show, a Legacies of Lesbian Literature author. She is an award-winning author and playwright. She said about Cheryl's writing, from her old-school titles to the conclusions ripped from today's headlines, Cheryl Head blends the old and the new into this very satisfying Charlie Mack Motown Mystery Series. A high praise indeed. Another review is from Grady Harp, a well-known LGBT reviewer, and he wrote this barely a month ago. He says, the pleasure of Cheryl's book is immersing yourself in the fever-pitched drama she writes with such finesse. This one shoots like a rocket. It is exhilarating. Highly recommended. Exhilarating is the perfect word for Cheryl's mysteries. I'm not going to pretend to be an expert on mysteries, but I'm fairly good at guessing. And I never quite knew what was going to happen, particularly in her second book, Wake Me When It's Over at the Detroit Auto Show, and Catch Me When I'm Falling, also set in Detroit. We are going to get Cheryl back on the line. Great. Well, then I'm going to talk to you, Linda.
All right.
All right. What did you think about the description of the Detroit Auto Show? Now, I've been to small auto shows, but that's not what this is.
Well, I couldn't believe it took, they worked on it for so long. I mean, they must have, because it was several levels, and, I mean, Detroit is the place for cars. And so I was really amazed about how long the people worked on it and how big it was, and so many factors to think about it. And she had all those details in there, and they weren't boring. I mean, she made the whole thing really interesting, and it made me feel like I was there, really.
And you've been to big festivals, in fact.
Yes. Yes, I have.
You have a lot of experience with them. But the organization that must go into a show like this.
Oh, my. I can't even. Makes mine look like peanuts.
What got me, and I was going to ask Cheryl this, but I'll ask you too. I'm used to mysteries where there's one bomb, possibly two, and you have to locate the bomb or the bomber. But this had a dozen or more bombs.
Oh yeah, more than a dozen, and plus so many other things going on, and like three or four people were killed. It amazed me how she tied it all together, and there were so many characters to think about it. It was on the verge of being too many to remember, but I think she really, you know, her descriptions of them and the feel of them were so different that it helped you remember all the characters, like the Chinese contingent and the American Chinese woman who was his secretary. I mean, she made her so believable, and, you know, in fact that she was Chinese American, that she understood the new ways and the old ways, and she behaved accordingly. And I find that interesting that she would think to do that in a novel, which makes it so much more interesting than just having a secretary do stuff.
What you just said makes perfect sense to me. Cheryl?
Yeah, I'm back. I'm sorry about that.
No, that's quite all right. We were talking about the fact that many mysteries have one bomb, and you're looking for a bomber and a bomb, and yet you had dozens sprinkled around this huge convention center in Wake Me When It's Over. What made you think of that?
Yeah, you know, it's a weird person.
Well, we're friends, but I will agree with you.
Okay.
It's like go big or don't go, right?
Right. So, I mean, I live in Washington, D.C., so, you know, we're hyper-alert about terrorism like people in New York are, I think. You know, because I am a mystery writer, I see the world a little bit differently, I think. I do think about people's darker sides and that kind of thing. So when I was conceiving of this idea of a terrorist attack against the Detroit Auto Show, I really did some thinking about, you know, what would be the most effective way to cause terror, you know? And it doesn't need to necessarily be a huge loss of life. It just means, you know, terrorism really is about fear. And because the auto show and the Super Bowl were within 3 weeks of each other in Detroit in 2006, I thought, what a wonderful premise to put that event in danger, and how would Charlie solve it. So, you know, maybe I'm a little bit weird thinking about stuff like that.
What made you think of the world of street people in Catch Me When I'm Falling? Because you are really very empathetic with that world and seem to understand it.
Yeah, I've known, you know, I think I thought about homelessness, and I'm going to write a bigger novel about the homeless population at some point, a standalone novel. But I've known people in D.C., friends of mine who have been social workers, and one of them also ran a homeless shelter, and I spent a lot of time talking to her about the issues that the people who use shelters have, the kind of people who come there, what happens at shelters, the kind of the state of homelessness. You know, home is central to all of us. All of us seek it in some way or another. It might be physical home, it might be emotional home, it might be geographic home. So what would make a person want to live on the street? What are the fears and the demons that drive people to live on the street? That is just a fascinating, I'm just interested in what the thinking is there. I know there is a lot of mental illness involved in the homeless population, so that's certainly a factor. But there are many other reasons why men and women are homeless. And the highest growing population within the homeless group are women and children, unfortunately, because of the economy. So in the first book, as you may recall, Elizabeth, Charlie's mom got lost because of her Alzheimer's, and two homeless men helped her. And so I wanted to bring one of those characters back to show a different aspect of their lives and to make them whole people, not just kind of a secondary or third kind of a piece of a plot in the first book.
Oh, that was such a good idea.
That's what I liked about your book. There were no flat characters. You really gave life and color to every character that you brought into the story.
Would you repeat what you said about the Chinese American woman and
the fact that the secretary who was to the Chinese delegation, the fact that she was Chinese American and she understood the old ways and the new ways and she behaved accordingly to who she was with made it so much more, made me remember her more and think about why she behaved a certain way.
Yeah. I loved writing that character, and I know there are cultures within America where the old and the new still are very relevant, and navigating those waters are very relevant. And so I thought about this character as she's second generation Chinese American in Detroit, and how she would, as a millennial, navigate understanding the traditions and the customs and the way she would behave with her parents and her boss, her Chinese boss. But also she's a young adult and she likes Beyonce. It was fascinating to write her character.
And she had a little bit of a romance in there, too.
And she had a little bit of a romance, and she was also brave. She helps to save someone in that story. And I want the women in my stories to be courageous and brave, because women are.
Like you.
That came across strongly, that the women in your stories were very brave and strong and fearless. I really appreciate it. I like reading stories like that. In fact, I tried to read mostly women authors with women lead characters, because with all the stuff that's going on in the news, it just makes me feel better to know that there are women out there like that.
It does, doesn't it?
Yes.
I agree with you.
you can only take so much of the news, and you got to go and to your own place.
Absolutely. And you may know this, Linda, because you read the genre so much. It's a pretty white male dominated space, the mystery world. But it's opening up. And I will say, I've been going to some of the mainstream mystery conferences, and people have been very inviting and kind of open. People of color and other kinds of people who are writing mysteries now are kind of new to the landscape. But people are embracing us, and I think they understand with the world changing, there are different kind of perspectives that can be brought to the genre that will still do justice to the kind of the tropes of the genre, but will add some new elements. There, for instance, Raymond Chandler, I love his stuff. It's set in a time where there's certain kinds of bigotries at play, but that doesn't, for me, diminish the value of the mystery. But there are several other people writing about Los Angeles, crime and mystery, including a woman named Naomi Hirahara. I think I'm getting her name correct. Walter Mosley, of course, wrote about the 1940s Los Angeles. So there's lots of perspective you can bring to the mystery genre that I just think makes it more interesting and exciting and gives it added value.
I just read a Japanese mystery about a woman who's a Japanese American, but she lives in Japan. I can't.
Yeah.
Was that who you were talking about? I can't remember the name of it right now, but I just read it.
Oh, that sounds fascinating. Yeah, I love those kinds of cultural stories. And I read male writers and women writers. There's one I would recommend. It's a little obscure. It's called Tokyo Zero, and it's a mystery. A Japanese-American police officer he's in Nagasaki, and he's trying to solve a serial killer crime in the weeks following the bombing of those two Japanese cities, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It's a fascinating read. It's a little dark and a little bit, it's a little creepy, but it's a really interesting read.
I appreciate, Cheryl, you introducing me deeper into the culture that is Detroit. And in your first book, Birmingham, Alabama plays a role. Do you you live in D.C. and you've spent much of your career in Washington, D.C. Do you see yourself setting a novel in Washington as well?
That's so interesting you asked that. I've spun off one of the characters and set him in D.C. And I'm having a hard time writing about it. I'm not sure if it's because he's not the right character for that mystery, or if I don't have the same kind of emotional connection to D.C. as I have to Detroit. I am grappling with that right now. D.C. is a different kind of city. It's transient. There are lots of communities and neighborhoods, but it also is very polarized. It's difficult when you first get there to find community. I moved to D.C. in the early 90s, and I didn't know anyone except for the one or two people I had met at the job I was going to take in public broadcasting. And through my reaching out to a lesbian support group, I finally developed some community. But it's a tough city to navigate if you don't know anyone. So, it's not that it doesn't have heart, but maybe it doesn't have the right heart for me.
I have heard that.
In
fact, I considered, I think it was in the early 90s, moving to Washington, D.C., and I thought, I just don't know if I could break in, and I have children, and I decided it was not a move for me. But
let me suggest this Japanese book for you. I found the name of it. It's The Brides of the Kimono, and it's written by, her last name's Massey, M-A-S-S-E-Y, and I don't know how to pronounce her first name, but it's S-U-J-A-T-A.
It's
a series.
She's a fabulous writer.
Yes.
She also, her new book, The Widows of Malabar Hill, is a dynamic book. You should get it, and it is Lammy nominated, and I think it's also nominated. I think it just won one of the major mystery awards. She's a great writer, and she's in Baltimore.
Let me ask you too, Cheryl, before we have to take a break. You've got another book coming out in October. Do you want to talk just a little bit about that?
That's right. Yeah, so here in D.C. 2.5 years ago, I got called to grand jury duty. I've always gone to my jury duty summons. When I've gotten summons, I've always gone. But I've never served on grand jury duty before. And in D.C., it involves showing up to court 5 days a week for 5 weeks. So it's like a full-time job for like a month and a half. And I was fascinated by the process, and because I'm a mystery and crime writer, and we heard 70 cases, I was just enthralled by what I heard. And, you know, it's a confidential process, and so for 18 months you really can't talk about any of the cases or what you've heard in that body of 23 jurors on grand jury. But the moment the 18 months was over, I was on it writing, taking notes and writing down my memories and experiences there. And so the fourth book, which is called Judge Me When I'm Wrong, will involve Charlie going to jury duty, not grand jury, but also a parallel case where they have a client whose son is going through a grand jury proceeding. So it will be a lot of court procedural stuff and some interesting twists on Charlie and Mandy's home life and a little bit of danger included.
I look forward to reading it.
Yes, me too.
Yeah, it's going to be fun, I think.
We're going to, in a minute, play a song by Gay Adegbolola called Queer Blues.
Oh, wonderful.
It seemed like a wonderful bridge between the first half of the show and the second half of the show.
Hello, Gay. Yeah, hello, Gay.
And I want to ask you, before we say goodbye, what your contact information is.
People can find me on Facebook. I treat Facebook like a kindergartner on the playground. If you ask to be my friend, I say yes. So I'm just put my name in there, Cheryl Head. My little brown face will pop up and friend me, and I'll friend you back. I'm at C-H-E-A-D-D-C on Twitter. I'm at C-Head Writes on Instagram. And beyond that, I don't do Pinterest or Snapchat or that kind of stuff.
But otherwise, you are everywhere.
And I have a website, CherylHead.com.
Thank you so much, Cheryl. Please go back
thank
to the
you,
beach
lady.
And have a wonderful day.
It was a really joy to talk to you.
I enjoyed being with you. Keep up the good work in public radio. Love it.
Thank you.
Ever since the day I was born, I knew I was not the same as the other little girls in my neighborhood who laughed and called me names. You know, I didn't like dolls. I didn't like dresses. My shame turned into fear. I love being queer.
Ann Apteker, hello.
Hi, I'm here.
So delighted to have you on the show again. We talked about Cantor Gold previously, about a year ago, a little over a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
But very excited that you have published Flesh and Gold. I wonder, I know you teach, so I'm going to ask mm-hmm. you to give the titles of each of your four books in order and one sentence about each one.
Okay. All right. Thank you. First of all, thank you for having me back on the show. It's a pleasure to be able to speak with you again, Elizabeth. Okay, the four books. The first one was Criminal Gold, and it took place in New York City in 1949, and it introduced the thief and smuggler, the art thief and smuggler, Cantor Gold, this dapper lesbian, and it introduced her in her story. The second was Tarnished Gold, taking place in 1950, New York City. Like the whole series, it puts Cantor and her thieving ways into great danger, where she also has to solve a mystery. And in this case, the person who's murdered is a Holocaust survivor, and it hits particularly close to home through cancer. The third book really brings her close to home, since Genuine Gold takes place in Coney Island. She was born and raised in Coney Island, and she has to go home there. The object that she had stolen for a client was in turn stolen by someone else and absconded with the Coney Island. So she has to go back into her childhood and back into her old neighborhood, which opens up a lot of cans of worms for her. And then the next one, the current one, Flesh and Gold, actually brings Cantor out of New York and puts her in Havana in 1952, in pre-Castro Havana, because she got a tip that the love of her life, Sophie de la Luna y Sol, who was mentioned way back in the first book, in Criminal Gold, had been stolen. It was kidnapped off the streets of New York, and Cantor eventually finds out that Sophie was brought to Havana in a sex trafficking situation. So Cantor goes to Havana to try and find Sophie and rescue her. And of course, while she's there, she gets involved in the Havana underworld, which at the time was a very interesting place, because in pre-Castro Cuba, you had the American mob moving in, taking over the casinos and the night spots, and it was all very glamorous and so on. But Cantor sees the underbelly of that too, the very dangerous side of Havana and the sex trafficking world and the casino world and the gang world. Well, so those are the four books.
You did write them, but you still get an A++.
Thank you.
I'm going to read a review for listeners. I was on Amazon looking at what people said about Anne's writing. One reviewer said, "You will be turning pages and exclaiming with horror, fear, and disgust. You will be celebrating, and you will lose tears. Once again, we are treated to some wonderful words that Anne Apteker uses like paints on a canvas." It was very true of this fourth book that we're going to talk to Anne about, Flesh and Gold, which, as she said, is set in 1952 in Havana. I was a little disappointed initially that there wasn't more art in your fourth book, and then I realized that your writing is like a painting. All of the dark and the shadows and the lights and the crispness and the florals. Would you talk a little about that, your intention?
Sure. As we mentioned earlier, Cantor is an art thief and a smuggler, and most of her books, most of her stories, in fact, all of them, to one degree or another, involve some stolen artifact or work of art. And it does in Flesh and Gold as well. But you're right, it kind of veers away from the art that she has to steal in Flesh and Gold to tell the deeper story of her trying to find Sophie. As far as your question is concerned, I'm glad that you recognize, I really do appreciate that you recognize that the language itself, the structure of the books and the language in which it's told, is indeed very important to me. For years and years, I was an art curator, so I bring my art knowledge into the book. And when you mount an art exhibition, what you're doing is creating a narrative, creating a world. And now I do it in terms of words as opposed to doing it in terms of images or sculptures. So that creating this world becomes the art itself. You're absolutely right. It does become the art itself. So the language and the book, not only does it have to have, I don't know, a depth of language, it also has to have a rhythm of language so that the reader is carried along into these stories without consciously being aware that there's a rhythm to it, but that their own internal human rhythm is being carried along into the world I create for them. So I'm really happy that you sort of picked up on that. That makes me feel good.
I want to bring Linda into the conversation. One of the things she's very good at, because she reads a lot of mysteries, is guessing what's going to happen or spotting twists. Linda, when you read this book, how did you do?
Not very good.
Oh, my.
You caught me there at the end with a real plot twist, so it was very interesting. It was hard to tell who was the good guy and the bad guy in this story. She met different characters, and they seemed to help her in the beginning, and then they turned on her so many times. So It was really interesting to follow that. And your writing is an art because it made me feel like I was there. I mean, I could see the when she walks into the room, she describes the desk and what's on the desk and what's, you know, everything. You really painted a picture of the scenery and what Havana was like. How did
thank you very much.
What kind of research did you do to know what Havana was like in 1952?
I did actually quite a bit of research. I had never been to Havana, but I knew that the story had to take place there because at that time, that would be the only place really that outside the country where an American or anyone else, a woman would be taken, the optimum profit in the sex trafficking trade would be to Havana. If the story was set, say, in the 20s or 30s, it would have been Shanghai. But because it was set in the 50s, it had to be Havana. So I had to do an enormous amount of research, both reading research and visual research, especially since I've never been there. And I wound up looking at maybe 1,000 pictures. And then, of course, on the Internet, there's all kinds of films and film scripts and newsreels and so on, and then all kinds of reading material and newspaper articles and so on. And so I just got as much as I could from my research and crossed my fingers that I got it right. And a friend of mine, actually, who has been to Havana, I was scared to death that she would say, no, it's really not like that. She said, wow, I nailed it, that it was like she was back there again. So that was a great relief. But yes, it involved an enormous amount of research, absolutely. But as far as the characters turning on her, because Canter Gold is not a standard procedural detective, either a private detective or a police person, she's a criminal, so she lives in the underworld. So her cast of characters, is going to be very different than you might find in another mystery or crime story. Things are never what they seem. People shift alliances. Everybody does what they have to do just to stay alive. And Candy's no different. She does what she has to do to stay alive. She has honor, but she will do what she needs to do to survive, as do all of the people that she encounters. And her relationships with them are actually very deep because they do understand each other, even when they're turning on each other. You know, she protects her heart at all costs, but she has one. And the people who she deals with, vicious as they may seem, in their way, they're all very vulnerable. Well, when you think about it, they wouldn't be criminals in the first place.
Canter stands out wherever she goes. She wears these crisp suits, one I think is gray with a pastel yellow shirt. She wears ties. Mm-hmm. She's got the hat. And except for one scene where she's dressed like a burglar, she makes no effort to blend in. And people glare at her. You know, they say, who is this woman who's dressing like a man? Why does Canter, and I'm asking you as the author, never try to, say, soft pedal it a little bit?
Well, because the society, whether in the United States or anywhere else, in the 50s, considers gay people, lesbians and gay men and trans people, the whole spectrum of the gay world, because we were considered criminals just for being who we were, that she doesn't owe the law or society any allegiance, so she may as well be a criminal and live her life as she chooses. So she's not going to soft-pedal it for anybody.
And I think that the fact that she didn't soft-pedal it for anybody, they respected her more.
In her world, they do. And the people in the straight world, just they have to deal with it. You know, they either ignore her or sit on her or whatever, but they have to deal with it. And in her underworld, they do respect her more because they know that she is not someone to be easily pushed around. Even after she just says hello, because there she is presenting herself fully as herself.
I have seen readers in online groups say that they prefer different points of view, and you have taken a very strong approach with your first-person point of view, and I think it works. I think it's extremely successful. What led you to that?
When I started thinking about writing the books in the first place, it's just the way I heard it. I heard Canter from the get-go, and I heard her telling her own story. And as a result of that, I just wrote it as her story. Writing something in first-person presence it's really immediate. You know, reading is a very intimate activity in the first place. When you read a story, when you read a book or a story, you're living that story. That story is in your head, in your body. So you're living the story, whether it's first person or third person. You're living that story as you read it. Well, once you put something into first person present, you're literally reading a particular human being's story. And you're encountering their highs and lows and their joys and their dangers with them at every moment. And I think in the case of Cantor, that intensity is very important to me as the author to give that experience to the reader. So I continue to do what's considered, you know, well, the other thing is ignorance really is bliss. I heard her canter, I heard her tell her story, so I've been writing it through her eyes and ears. I find out later that many writers consider first person, especially first person present, to be the most difficult voice to write in. Well, when I first started writing her, I had no idea. I was really a newbie, really a novice. And so ignorance really is bliss, and I just did it. So there I am, and now I feel very comfortable with it. Short stories that have been published that have been in, you know, standard third person, and others have been in first person past or third person past. So I write all over the place, but Cantor remains in first person present.
When you were talking about that, I was wondering how you write that, because it's so easy to slip into other, you know, point of view from somebody else when you're writing something. And I was really impressed by the way you, you know, stayed focused on her and her thoughts and her actions. And everything was a surprise to her and as it was to the reader as we went along.
Absolutely. You know, sometimes crime and mystery writers will know who done it, you know, because they'll plot it out and so on. And that's fine. But for me, I don't know who done it until Cantor does. I don't know the murderer until Cantor realizes who it is. So as I was writing Flesh and Gold, I had, as the author, I had a few other people in mind who could have been the killer. But as the story evolves and starts to write itself, when Cantor knew who the killer was, that's when I knew who the killer was. And I enjoy that adventure that I don't know who the killer is.
Well, when you do it that way, do you have to go back and change a few details to make it fit the story? Or does it just come out that way?
It just rolls along. At some point in writing the book, I lose control in the most positive way, in that the book starts to write itself, so to speak. It just evolves into its own logic. And there I am, just hearing the logic, hearing the story. I sort of see it and hear it at the same time, and I just set it down. So, yes, when Cantor finds out who the killer is, that's when I know who the killer is, because the logic of the story had taken over, and it had to be that person.
One of the things I appreciated so much about your writing is you clearly did do a lot of research, but you didn't put too much of it in the book. You refer, for instance, to the revolutionaries in the hills. Those of us who have read about Castro and his coming to power know that you're talking about the guerrillas, and you talk about the gang warfare, and you talk about rolling cigars, hand-rolling them, and just wonderful touches, but you don't overdo it. Are you ever tempted and have to pull back?
Well, yes and no, in a way. I research far more than I use, but that's okay because it's there for me to pull from. In a way, you know, you sort of want to use everything that you've researched. The story tells you not to. It's just a matter of hearing again, you know, of how much is enough. Of you know, Cantor telling her story of her experiences. She's not a history professor telling you about the times and so on. She is living at that moment. And so the historical detail that she transmits is has to be in service to what she's doing at the time. So the references to the guerrillas in the hills are because they are having an influence on the crime world in Havana at that time. So she doesn't have to go into a lot of detail. She just has to work through that. She has to be aware that that's happening. And so that's why you get these tidbits, just enough to make it part of the story. Everything that's in any given story, in my way of thinking, any piece of texture or color or historical tidbit, if it's a historical novel, has to be in service to the story and in service to the characters who are living that story. Everything else is just a data dump, and I try not to do that.
As a reader, I appreciate that so much. I've read, unfortunately, some novels where someone says, and then I saw a bison. The bison is an American mammal that, I just throw the book across the room, I'm done.
So a woman asked me to read her book, to critique it before she tried to publish it, and I told her she needed to flesh it out a little more. There wasn't enough detail, and it was just her, somebody doing something. She never talked to me again. It's like, I said to her, do you want the truth or do you want me to tell you it's great?
Oh, my.
but it is that. That's totally the difference in a good book and just, you know, saying what happened. Because just saying what happened is not a story.
No.
No. And I'll tell you a little secret. I'll pass it on to your listeners who may be thinking about being writers themselves. And I'm happy to pass on the secret because it was a secret that was given to me by another writer, wonderful writer named Shelley Singer, who also teaches crime and mystery writing. And she facilitates, she edits other authors and so on. And Shelley passed along to me in a classroom situation this little tidbit that writing a narrative, writing a novel, whether it's crime and mystery or romance or sci-fi or anything, any fiction is not the story of the plot, it's the story of the emotion.
Yes.
And when I heard that, that opened up the entire process for me. Because it's the emotions, whether they're high emotions or low emotions, we all experience them all the time. And it's the emotions that drive the action of what anybody does at any given moment, from being lazy to being active. And so that opened up the process for me. In other words, that told me to write the story from inside the experience of the character. Instead of what they're doing, it's what they're feeling. And what they're feeling determines what they say. And what they say and determines what they do. So I write it from inside their gut, whether it's Cantor's or the other characters. When they're speaking, I'm writing it from inside of them.
Well, your book brought up a lot of emotions in me, so you did a good job with that.
Oh, good.
And I'm going to have to purposefully be very vague here, but Linda read Flesh and Gold before I did, and she said, there's mm-hmm. this one scene. And mm-hmm. I didn't know.
Just one?
Well, I hit the scene, and I gasped, and it evoked, as you said, all sorts of emotions. Did you ever, and again, I realize I'm being vague for those who have not mm-hmm. read Flesh and Gold, but did you ever worry about it being too dark?
No, I didn't worry about it until after the book was published, believe it or not. I know the scene you're talking about, and as I wrote it, I was experiencing, let's put it this way, it was extremely difficult to write, as you can imagine.
That was my next question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was very, very difficult to write. But I had to put, or the story, you know, at that point, I'm not so sure how much control I was having over the story, because it happens almost two-thirds of the way through the book. And Cantor had to face, in a way, the ultimate moral conundrum. And so that is the ultimate moral conundrum, what she had to do in order to continue her search for love. You know, she had to weigh love up against the horror that she was facing without giving away the mm-hmm. danger. But it just became the ultimate moral conundrum. When you face what she faced, that is the ultimate moral conundrum. And as someone who does everything to survive, and yet she has honor, she knew what the consequences of these actions were going to be. She knew. But she had to face this conundrum. She had to make this decision. She could not get out of this decision. She was forced into that decision.
Right. Well, and I think that's the key right there. She was forced
exactly.
into it. She did not
she was
seek
forced
it
into
out.
It. No, not at all. She was nauseous, she was.
So was I.
Yeah, and I was tied up in knots as I was writing it. It was horrifying to me to write it. But if Cantor had no choice, neither did I. And then the thing is though, she survives that conundrum. She's affected by it deeply, and she will carry that effect with her through the remaining book, through the rest of her life. But she goes on. She's a life force. She is about living. She's about life. Nothing will squelch her sense of life. At the end of the book, you know, she's in danger of having it squelched. But after all is said and done, she is, for me, the spark of life. and she will continue to live.
Ah, speaking of continuing to live, will there be another Cantor Gold book?
Oh, yes, there will be. I've already started making notes about it.
I was going to say there has to be, because you can't leave her in that way you left her.
No, and I won't.
Is she going back to Gotham? Started.
Yes, she will, absolutely. She's in the, you know, she already is back in Gotham. Yeah, she, oh, of course she's going to be back in Gotham. She lives in the Brickwork and stuff. But I've already started making notes about it. There's other projects that I have to do, that I have to finish first, but I've already started making serious notes about it. So, oh yes, indeed, there will be more Cantor Gold.
What's your history with the Mafia? Do you have an insight on it, or did you have to do a lot of research on that too?
A lot of research. I live in New York, so the research on the Mafia is sort of right there at my doorstep. It's very easy here in New York to research the Mafia. First of all, there's a lot written about them no matter where you live. It's pretty easy to research the Mafia altogether. But here in New York, where so much of the Mafia, you know, New York and Chicago, but for me, New York, so much of the Mafia was operating, the five families and so on. And of course, in Flesh and Gold, we meet Meyer Lansky, who was a big deal New York Mafia guy. It's actually very easy for me to research gangs and crime here in New York. It's all over the place.
We're a little bit short on time, so I want to ask you, your books are published by Bold Strokes Books. Is the best way to find you through Bold Strokes? Do you have your own personal website? How does someone find you?
Yes, you can. If you buy through Bold Strokes, that's probably the most efficient way of doing it. But other than that, Bold Strokes distribution arms are, you know, it's a very wide net, so you can get it through all the usual places, wherever you buy your book, online, or you can have your local bookstore order them. If they don't already have them, they can order them through their standard ordering distribution procedures. So fortunately, Bold Strokes books are available far and wide, so you can do that.
And on Kindle ebooks and stuff.
Yes, Kindle ebooks and all formats of ebooks. You know, there's all the formats of ebooks. So you can get through Amazon and Barnes and Noble or whoever you buy your books from, both print book and ebook.